equal time. Another viewpoint, other considerations. Equal time.
Good afternoon. This is Carl Ettnayer, your host for Equal Time Radio on Mondays. My theme, as usual, is energy, food, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. And we're going to be focusing on the, I guess it's a food section, but we'll be talking about energetics in the second part of the show today. And the first part of the show, we have here in the studio, Kate Farm farmer Richard Wiswall from East Montpelier. He's just come out through Vermont's publisher Chelsea Green with the Organic Farmer's Business Handbook, a complete guide to managing finances, crops, and staff, and making a profit. And that comes with a companion CD. He says that he netted $10,000 based on 2 days work when he first applied his methods. So a little office work can boost farmers' profits a lot. And this book, he says, is pretty applicable to small business people out there, too, who aren't on farms. Farmers are small business people. And, you know, for those of you who aren't running a small business and who aren't farming, well, I think it's important to understand what farming is all about from a business perspective. We talk a lot about local food and how good it is, but, you know, let's put ourselves in the shoes of people who are out there getting their shoes muddy every day, feeding the food for us. We want them to be making a good living at that so we can have ever more of them. Richard will help us understand how to see more of that. In the second part of the show, we'll be talking with local wastewater expert on many things, Buzz Ferver. He's going to talk about how we can feed the soil with the nutrients from human wastewater. That'll be coming up in the second part of the show. So, fresh in from Kate Farm in East Montpelier, Richard Wiswall, welcome to the studio.
Thank you, Carl.
How are you going to keep them down on the farm once you've seen Waterbury?
I kind of like Waterbury. I don't get here enough.
So, you've got a brand new book out. You were signing it at Bear Pond Books in Montpelier recently. Had an opening party at the Black Door there. What led you to write the Organic Farmer's Business Handbook?
There's a lot of information out there for farmers on how to produce, how to grow things. Information about soils and composting and growing plants and animals. But there's very little information about how to actually run a business doing that. And I've been doing it long enough that I've kind of figured out the best way of doing it for me over the years, and that's involved a lot of mistakes. And I just soon try to give people a leg up so they don't have to make the same mistakes that I've done over the last 27 years. I also consult with other farmers around New England, helping them with their business of their farms, writing business plans. And I see the same common themes and mistakes being made over and over, and I see a real need for these to be addressed. Farmers, you know, they work hard because they believe in what they do. And a lot of times when the finances don't work out, farmers will just work longer hours, put in a few extra, you know, evenings or whatever it needs to take. But ideally, it'd be better to actually just sharpen the pencil and focus on the business end and farm smarter, not harder, so they can actually net more profit. And what you said at the beginning about, you know, those 2 days that I spent behind a calculator and records and, you know, figured out what all the different crops were making so I could emphasize the profitable ones and not grow the less profitable ones, it automatically raised my bottom line by $10,000. And on the outside, my farm didn't look any different. Same people work there. Everything else looked the same, except that I was just knowledgeable of what was actually making money or not.
Were you working harder the next year when you netted $10,000 more?
I was working smarter, and I was probably working at the same pace, but being much more effective at putting money into my bank account at the end of the year.
Well, tell it. That's a very simple system, the way you describe it in the book, but as you've just demonstrated for us, very powerful. If it can increase your profits by $10,000 a year. Tell us what system you used those 2 days.
Farmers do a lot of different things on a farm. A diversified vegetable farm might grow 40 or 60 different crops. Any farm will do different enterprises. They might raise pigs, sheep, blueberries, honeybees. Even a dairy farm with one product, milk, has different enterprises within that farm. They might, you know, raising replacement heifers, making hay, raising grains, putting up silage. All these things contribute to their year-end net profit or loss. And that average, you know, there's a basic business equation: profit equals income minus expenses, and that's usually only calculated once a year. And thank goodness for the IRS, because without the IRS annual tax forms, we wouldn't even do that. And we just rely on our checkbook balance to figure out how we did financially.
You're the first guest I've ever had who said, thank goodness for the IRS.
It might be the last, too. And so we calculate this kind of profit and loss at the end of the year, but it's really an average of all the things we do on the farm. And we need to dissect all those different pieces in order to say, well, which ones are really the profit centers and which ones may actually be losing money. And that kind of number crunching I did when I had a revelation, you know, 15 years ago, saying I really want to get to the bottom of this to make it work, I ended up, you know, meticulously tracking which crops, what expenses were going to each crops and versus the sales, and which ones were actually paying the bills and which ones weren't. I just dropped the bottom half of the list and said, well, I'm not going to grow these crops, and I'll just emphasize the ones that I do find profitable, and automatically my bottom line rose by $10,000.
So this list was arraying the crops that you grew from top to bottom, from the most profitable to the least profitable.
Correct.
Or maybe there were some that you were making a loss at. I don't know.
That's correct. There were some that were making a loss, and I rated them on a per acre basis. So I would kind of, even though I would grow a tenth of an acre of some things or 3 acres of another thing, I would rate them side by side so I could get a comparison, a valid comparison.
Sure.
And I would try to find markets for the ones that are more profitable, even if I grew a lot of them or I didn't grow much of them. Mm. And kind of let go of the ones that weren't making money. The other thing is, you can, you know, that profit equals income minus expense equation, you can alter your profitability by increasing your income. You can raise the sale price if you can, sometimes you can't, and you can lower expenses or do both. And so you can become more efficient producer and raise your profit that way as well. So it's not a matter of just dropping crops because they aren't as profitable as another one. You want to look at that profitability equation for each one. Mm.
So this is, in the next year, you were farming the same amount of land.
Correct.
And you raised your profits by $10,000 on a small family farm in East Montpelier.
That's right. And $10,000 on your net profit is where it counts. You know, all of a sudden, you know, you can raise your gross sales by $10,000, but if you spend $10,000 doing it, you know, it's a zero-sum game.
Mm. Well, that's got to make the family happy.
Oh, yeah. No, it was a huge light bulb that went off in my head just to kind of see where all that money's coming and going. And, you know, maybe another business person would say, well, Richard, you know, duh, you know, why wouldn't you figure this out? But, you know, any farmer would understand that there's this hectic and maybe frenetic pace of life, depending on what's happening with the weather and the markets or with labor force, any number of things that are kind of pushing your business one way or the other, that it's really easy not to pay attention to those things in the season. I mean, the growing season is, you know, pretty short from mid-April until November, middle of November outside. And, you know, you want to get a lot of things done in that time. And, you know, you probably don't want to be spending time at your desk. And if you are, you're probably doing it at 10 o'clock at night and, you know, instead of sleeping or reading a book. So
it's important to be putting in that time at the desk ahead of time before the growing season starts.
So what I would like to, you know, what I like to do is to try to do as minimal informational gathering during the growing season when it's really busy, and then compile all that data in the wintertime when, or in the off season when I have more time to do that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the things that I recommend, you know, are not time consuming. They're not hard, but they do have to be done on a regular basis. And I liken it to, you know, brushing your teeth. You know, it's much better for you to brush your teeth twice a day, every day, and then go to your 6-month checkup, as opposed to going to the dentist or not brushing your teeth at all for 6 months and going to the dentist and brushing three hours nonstop before the appointment, it's not as effective. And so I set up these simple templates and routines that you get into, whether it's taking inventory before and after farmers market or whether it's writing down in a crop journal just a single entry of each crop when you perform a task, when you perform some task on that crop as it happens. So then you have a kind of a record of how much expense is really going into that crop. Mm. I mean, there's a lot of expenses that are already recorded. Say I buy some beet seed, I buy some fertilizer, I buy some mulch, and I sow my crop, and then I harvest them and put them in some plastic bags that I have a receipt for. But there's a lot of expenses in between the seeding and the packing out that aren't recorded.
The labor expenses.
Well, those are actually sort of recorded because you have a paycheck for your employees, but you're paying them for a 40-hour work week without ever breaking it down to what they're actually doing, you know, crop by crop. And your own labor as a farmer, you're not recording because you're not writing yourself a paycheck generally. You're just living off of the profits at the end of the year.
So you set up a simple system with a few pieces of paper to keep track of people's labor on a crop-by-crop basis.
It's actually the most important book on my farm. It's a really basic set of loose-leaf papers listed alphabetically, you know, artichokes, beets, carrots, dandelion, echinacea, and just in that kind of order. And so when I weed carrots, I'll write down four people times 2 hours, and then...
Do you weed the dandelions?
We actually do weed the dandelions. We grow some things that people look at as kind of funny, like dandelion and burdock.
Yeah.
We have my neighbor dairy farmers come over, and they drive by, and they'll say, Richard, what is that beautiful field that... It looks like they're planted nice straight rows. It looks like burdock and not a weed in the field. And I said, well, yeah, you got it. That's burdock.
What do you grow the dandelions for, the leaves or the roots?
We grow them for both. Right now, we have more of a market for the roots.
Mm. So anyway, we're getting off track into your cropping system, but you've just got this simple book with each crop and
so basically, in terms of recording expenses, I can actually figure out what my labor costs for each crop are because I just separate them by beets or carrots or potatoes. And that way I'll have real numbers at the end of the year when I take my sales for that crop. I'll be able to line up all the expenses, the seed, which is from receipts, and all the labor I can just multiply up by what I pay my people. And then I'll have a real true profit equals income minus expense per crop. Mm. And that's what I rate side by side.
Yeah. If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Richard Wiswall. He is the author newly, of the Organic Farmer's Business Handbook, A Complete Guide to Managing Finances, Crops, and Staff, and Making a Profit, just out on Chelsea Green. Richard has been farming for 27 years on Cape Farm in East Montpelier. I'm Carl Etnayer, your Monday host for Equal Time. In just a minute, we'll find out how the Organic Farmer's Business Handbook can help small businesses that aren't on farms. We'll be back after this. Welcome back to Equal Time. I'm Carl Etnayer, your Monday host. My guest with me is Richard Wiswall, farmer in East Montpelier on Cape Farm, author of the Organic Farmer's Business Handbook. And we just heard a promotional ad before we got back on the air, and that's maybe something that Cape Farm doesn't do. Do you do a rutabaga giveaway or anything like that?
We've done advertising for plant sales that we have at the farm. We don't sell any retail at the farm except for 3 Sundays in May. Mm. And we'll advertise for that event. But generally, and we'll sometimes advertise local in some local newspapers as well.
Mm. Word of mouth and farmers markets are a great thing for small farms.
Well, that's one of the untold benefits of being at the farmers market is that, you know, you actually get some front FaceTime with people, and if you're out in the community, which is a form of advertising. Mm.
Doesn't keep us on the air here, but that's all right. So you've written the Organic Farmer's Business Handbook, but you've also said that this is useful for small business people who aren't in farming. I mean, the difference between a farmer and a homesteader, as I understand it, is that a farmer is raising stuff to sell off the farm, so a farmer is pretty much by definition a business person.
Absolutely, and I think most farmers kick and scream when they're called business people because they somehow separate farming from business. And there's a couple of other activities, I would think, artists and musicians kind of fall in that same category where we have this head in the sand approach to business and just hope it all works out. And, you know, ultimately we can't do that. We have to, you know, we handle lots of money a lot of times, and if we want to keep any of it, we have to pay attention to where it's coming and going.
So if I own a restaurant or a bookstore or a small radio station, then how could this book help me?
There's the first half of the book is kind of farmer-centric, and it definitely addresses the needs of farmers. It deals with planning and some concepts of agriculture and some very detailed budgets of, you know, each crop that, or 24 different crops of, you know, their profitability. The second half of the book deals with much more broader concepts that are, you know, applicable to any small business, things like a whole chapter on marketing, novel ways of taking a look at marketing. Paper flows, you know, every business has paper flows, either sales or expenses, but there's, you know, plenty of ways that you can improve the efficiency in your office, and it's one thing you don't really get taught anywhere. And I just show basic systems where you can make your office more efficient, so you don't have, you know, you have a kind of a resting spot on your paper, on along the paper trail for these different sets of papers, so they're, you know, processed accordingly and efficiently. When I first started putting my books on a computer, when the advent of the personal computers came around in the 1990s, early 1990s, I hired a bookkeeper to put all my invoices onto a spreadsheet. And she found $800 in errors, and different types of errors of lost income. And that's net income. And, you know, in one sense, well, $800, that's less than 0.5% on a gross of $150,000. What's a big deal? But I'll tell you, Carl, if I dropped $800 on the ground right now, you'd pick it up.
I would.
Well, I would.
I would, definitely.
And those are leaks that I didn't even know about. That's the crazy thing, is that you don't even know you're losing that net profit. It would be like if, you know, you had a hole in your wallet and you're just dropping $20 bills as you walk down the streets of Waterbury. And so those are the kind of leaks that I kind of make sure there's systems in place so you don't lose money out of your wallet like that. And there's some other things that I address with any business has to deal with, is the tax effect and business spending tactics. And there's quite a bit of tax bite that comes out of your net profit. As a sole proprietor, I pay a full third of my income to taxes. Okay, so if I make $60,000, I actually write a check for $20,000 to taxes. And you go, what? How can that be? You know, we don't get health care, education, or any services like that. You think
it's your kids get educated at the local schools.
No, that's true. No, that's true. But that's not even local taxes. This is actual, the way it works down is 15% goes to your federal tax, and that's the lowest rate. And then 15% goes to self-employment tax, because being self-employed, you pay both ends of self-employment tax. Normally, if you're employed by someone else, the employee pays 7.5% and the employer contributes 7.5%. But being self-employed, you get the benefit of paying both sides of that. And then you pay 4% to your state income tax. So that's 34% of everything you make goes to taxes. And, you know, there's a big difference between tax avoidance and tax evasion. The first one's legal, the second one's not. And the IRS...
Which one are you promoting?
I'm promoting tax avoidance. And the IRS encourages businesses to capitalize, because if, you know, if I'm going to make a $45,000 net profit at the end of the year, I'm going to pay a third of that, or $15,000 in taxes. But if I buy a $30,000 tractor, my net profit is only $15,000, because it's a bona fide farm business expense, that I only pay taxes on $15,000, but I still own the tractor. So the tractor saved me, you know, almost $10,000 in taxes. So, you know, a lot of businesses will buy down their profit at the end of the year to avoid paying taxes on it.
And you have some nice charts that show the effect of various decisions along those lines.
That's right. And those are the kind of tips that any small business person is aware of or should be aware of, because it's very important to, you know, their bottom line, keeping money where they want it.
Mm. Well, one of the strengths of this book is the detailed charts and the companion CD, which has Excel spreadsheets that people can use, and also with other programs, I understand, to do, and this is more farming specific, I believe, everything that's on the companion CD, set up a budget for a crop and do a payroll and that sort of thing.
The CD, I wanted the book to be very useful. I wanted the book to really help farmers and small business people. And so on the CD is one thing, is a payroll calculator. And I got so tired of paying payroll. At first, you know, QuickBooks would offer payroll services through their software. And then when I upgraded, I had to start paying for it. And then my bank was charging $500 to do payroll. And I'm thinking, like, you know, I did the pencil test, and it only takes me, you know, about an hour a month to do it. I'll do it myself. And so then I wrote my own Excel spreadsheet to figure out all the taxes. And I include that in the book so people don't need to be paying for their own payroll.
And that would work for any small business.
Any small business. Okay. And I also include a timesheet that goes along with it. I include a job description, so it just kind of covers basic things that, you know, employees are expected of employees. And then there's also the budgets, which I detail for vegetables, but as well, there's a workbook, an Excel workbook by the Vermont Farm Viability Program, which is much more of a comprehensive tool that does everything from balance sheets to profit and loss statements to cash flow projections to evaluating your business on different indicators. And that is courtesy of the Vermont Farm Viability Program, that it's printed on the CD, but it's a very useful, comprehensive tool, especially if you're doing business planning.
Well, let's close out our time here, Richard Wiswall, by talking about the Vermont Small Farm Viability Program, because, you know, it's great to have this wonderful, comprehensive book to have in your hands, but a lot of people, myself included, work a lot better when we have a person to talk to, or several people to talk to, talk over our ideas and really get some personalized advice. I understand that that's a resource available to Vermont small farmers.
I think this program is probably the best money around to spend on agriculture. It's a way of consulting one-on-one with a farm family to write a business plan to address their profitability and their long-term goals. And it works with a farmer on their needs, and comes out at the end of a year-long process addressing everything from marketing to financials to long-range planning and implementation. So there's a real solid document that kind of it's a roadmap to how to get to where they want to go.
How much does that cost a farmer to participate?
The program is actually free to farmers. And I would, you know, call the Vermont Farm Viability Program or look it up online at www.vhcb.org.
I'll put that link on the website right after the show. So, there's a lot of volunteer labor used in the small farm viability projects, so it doesn't cost the taxpayers as much as, you know, hiring in fancy Madison Avenue consultants would, I suppose.
Well, it's some volunteers, but other people, consultees work, are hired by the program, absolutely.
Okay.
And that's where their monies go, to pay people to help write business plans, but it is free to the farmer.
Got it. Richard Wiswall, author of the Organic Farmer's Business Handbook. Any final words?
Thank you very much, Carl, for having me.
Thanks for being on the show. Coming up next, we'll be talking with Buzz Ferver. He's a wastewater expert. He'll tell us how we can feed the soil with nutrients from wastewater and why we ought to be thinking about where our water's coming from in the years ahead. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Equal Time. I'm Carl Ettnayer, your Monday host. Coming up, we're going to be talking about wastewater. Exciting subject? Well, actually, I devoted a lot of my career to that before I got into focusing on food, energy, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. So I think so, but I think you will as well. We're talking with Buzz Ferver. He's a local wastewater expert from Worcester, and he thinks about wastewater in a whole different way than most people in the industry do. Buzz, welcome to the show.
Hello, Carl. How are you doing?
Good. Before we begin talking, I just want to read from this article in yesterday's New York Times. This is November 22nd, Sunday, New York Times. It's called, As Sewers Fill, Waste Poison Water Poisons Waterways. This is one view of wastewater. It was drizzling lightly in late October when the midnight shift started at the Owl's Head Water Pollution Control Plant, where much of Brooklyn's sewage is treated. At Owl's Head, a swimming pool's worth of sewage and wastewater was soon rushing in every second. Warning horns began to blare. A little after 1 a.m., with a harder rain falling, Owl's Head reached its capacity and workers started shutting the intake gates. That caused a rising tide throughout Brooklyn's sewers, and untreated feces and industrial waste started spilling from emergency relief valves into the Upper New York Bay and Gowanus Canal. Bob Connaughton, one of the plant's engineers, said, it happens any time you get a hard rainfall. Sometimes all it takes is 20 minutes of rain and you've got overflows across Brooklyn. One of the goals of the Clean Water Act of 1972 was to upgrade the nation's sewer systems, many of them built more than a century ago, to handle growing populations and increasing runoff of rainwater and waste. During the 1970s and 1980s, Congress distributed more than $60 billion to cities to make sure that what goes into toilets, industrial drains, and street grates would not endanger human health. But despite these upgrades, many sewer systems are still frequently overwhelmed. As a result, sewage is spilling into waterways. In the last 3 years alone, more than 9,400 of the nation's 25,000 sewage systems, including those in major cities, have reported violating the law by dumping untreated or partly treated human waste, chemicals, or other hazardous materials into rivers and lakes and elsewhere. A 2007 study published in the journal Pediatrics, focusing on one Milwaukee hospital, indicated that the number of children suffering from serious diarrhea rose whenever local sewers overflowed. Another study, published in 2008 in the Archives of Environmental and Occupational Health, estimated that as many as 4 million people become sick each year in California from swimming in waters containing the kind of pollution often linked to untreated sewage. Finally, one personal story. This is Lori Serrano, whose Bayshore, New York home was damaged in 2005 by a sewer overflow. She says, after the storm, the sewage flowed down the street faster than we could move out of the way and filled my house with a foot of muck. Ms. Serrano, who says she contracted viral meningitis because of exposure to the sewage, has filed suit against Suffolk County, which operates the sewer system. The county's lawyer disputes responsibility for the damage and the injuries. She says, Ms. Serrano says, I had to move out, and no one will buy my house because the sewage was absorbed into the walls. I can still smell it sometimes. So problems with the aging centralized sewer collection systems and sewage treatment plants in this country. But Buzz Ferver, the emphasis on, or the implication of this article I get is that the country needs to make a lot of investment in upgrading its centralized sewer systems. But I think you have a different take on it.
Well, I do, Carl. I mean, to me, I mean, I take a look at that whole situation. Every time it rains more than an inch, most major cities are overwhelmed at the sewage treatment plant because they have what's called combined sewers. So it's combined with stormwater. Almost all major cities are this way. So as it rains, stormwater is going right in with the sewage.
Stormwater is the runoff from the rain.
Every time it rains, the stormwater is the water that's running down the street is collected and, you know, drops into the grates and goes into the drains under the streets and ends up going to the sewage treatment plant in almost all major cities in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And then is treated just like it was sewage at great cost and then, you know, released into whatever body of water is close by, whatever bay or river. And so they're not designed to take a huge rain. So now when you're reading about Brooklyn, if 20 minutes of hard rain, they're dumping raw sewage mixed with stormwater right into the whatever bay that is.
And stormwater does, especially the first bit of stormwater after a rain event begins, does contain some nasty stuff, but it's a completely different composition for and needs to be treated completely differently than human sewage.
It's not pathogenic to people. It's not going to cause disease. Typically, stormwater coming off the street or your yard isn't going to cause disease. So it doesn't need to go into those stormwater grates. It's just that's the way the cities were designed. They were designed for all that water to go into the same system. And you're talking now about it's not millions, it's billions and billions of dollars of re-engineering the entire cities across this country to split the stormwater away from the sewage.
Mm.
And that doesn't get at the whole crux of the bad idea of, I mean, is it really a good idea to be mixing human waste, excrement, urine and feces in drinking water mm-hmm. as a way to convey it away mm-hmm. from where we live? It was a good idea when there was an away that we could send it to, but everyone lives downstream. There's no away to send that waste to now. So huge costs and huge infrastructure to treat that sewage so that we can then release it as per our permits into the rivers, lakes, oceans, and streams that surround us. And typically that water is then picked up a half a mile downstream to get treated for drinking water for the next town.
What's the alternative?
Well, the alternative is for everybody who's able, everybody who's motivated, and everybody who can on a small scale to get themselves to use as little water to treat their waste as possible. And that's by using compost toilets such as Clivus Multrums or the Phoenix brand or Ecolette or this whole series of brands of composting toilets. The Humanure system is a real simple, real elegant sawdust in a bucket that you empty every day into a compost pile. At the talk I gave Thursday night, there was a woman in the audience who'd been treating her waste from her house for 46 years by taking the bucket out to the compost pile.
Yeah, I have a sawdust toilet, just a bucket full of wood shavings that I add more wood shavings to every time I use, and I actually don't take it out every day. I take it out every week or so when it fills up, because the wonderful thing about that, contrast to these composting toilets that are always drawing air out of your house and through the compost and cooling down your house in the winter that way, the wonderful thing about that is that the wood shavings on top of the urine and feces just keep the smell down.
Yeah. Well, we have developed some serious fecal phobia, to quote Joseph Jenkins from the Humanure Handbook, in this country, where we're very worried about our feces. But you read that story you just did where the woman contracted meningitis
mm-hmm.
because of it. Feces is pathogenic.
That's because of the sewage treatment plant.
Well, what it is because someone's sewage that was going into that treatment plant had meningitis.
Mm-hmm.
And that meningitis wasn't killed. The pathogens were still alive. So the paranoia, the big paranoia about disease and human feces is very real. So it can cause tremendous different problems of human sickness and feces. It's a lot of our disease is transmitted through the feces, or it's active in the feces. We can get it. We come in contact with it. So that's why you have to be very careful with management. But you have a whole city's full of people. That's a lot of possible pathogenic vectors. But just your own feces as a single family, a single home, well, you know if you're sick, you know if you have worms, you know if you have some viral, or bacterial disease that could be passed to others, and you're going to take much greater precautions, and, you might not encourage people at your house who had meningitis to come there and go to the bathroom. You know what I mean? It's like,
well,
please don't use this facility if you're that sick. Matter of fact, I want you to stay at home.
I don't screen my visitors for before I let them into the bathroom.
Well,
but on the other
so
hand,
the fecal phobes will tell you that there's risk involved there when you're handling waste.
Yeah, I've got the sawdust toilet in the upstairs where
no one can get to.
Where my guests don't generally go to.
Well,
right?
I mean, and I have a composting toilet. I've been living with a composting toilet for 25 years, and I don't screen anyone either. And I've had parties. I have parties every year, every other year, here with 150 people, and they're all using that very freely. And, in that situation, that material, I'm not going to come in contact with it or touch it for 7 or 8 years in my composting toilet.
Gives a lot of time for the pathogens to be killed.
Yeah, a lot of time for those pathogens to have been destroyed through both time and fungal and bacterial activity as the compost breaks down.
We're talking to Buzz Ferver. He is a wastewater expert, amongst other things, here in Worcester, Vermont. And we're talking about a different view of wastewater, its problems and its opportunities. If we're going to go to the phones now to Barry. Dick, welcome back to the show.
How are you doing?
Good, thanks. What's on your mind?
Most interesting. Brought back memories. I worked on the Owl's Head plant when it was upgraded. I guess it must have been 25, 30 years ago.
Boy, you've done nuclear work and you've done wastewater work as well.
Well, I worked in the construction business as a project manager, and your boss says, go do the job. You don't really select the job, per se. You end up doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And it rubs off. I worked at Ward's Island, which is the largest sewage plant in the city of New York.
So what are your insights on that New York Times story from your work at Owl's Head?
Oh, goodness. Everything you said is accurate and 100%. The problem started when they decided to, I'll be polite, stop having people throwing waste out the windows, as was done in the early 1800s, literally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they put piping in the streets. The problem was they went to a single pipe system from day one.
Mm.
It was done because of economics and availability.
Mm.
Well, it's never changed. And what you said, the amount of storm runoff exceeds the capacity of the plants. Simple.
And they're designed that way, right?
And they're designed that way. So there is no alternative at that point, short of tearing up every street, in this case, because Owl's Head is one of many New York City plants, short of tearing up every street in the city to convert to a two-pipe system. And that, of course, the cost would be beyond prohibitive, as well as being just plain impractical.
Mm.
So you're stuck with this system, which no matter what you do, can never work under extreme condition.
Mm. Have you ever worked with these composting toilets or these sawdust toilets that Buzz Ferver is talking about, Dick?
The problem is, in a major urbanized area such as the city of New York or any other major city, where would you then deposit the composting toilet matter?
Mm-hmm.
There's no system for that.
Let's ask Buzz.
Well, that stuff would have to be taken someplace and used to grow.
And at this point, as if you've seen pictures of almost every major metropolis, you've got garbage cans and bags of garbage at the street waiting for the truck to come by and pick it up. Well, having what amounts to untreated human waste sitting at the curbside, that's not allowable either.
Okay, thanks for the call, Dick.
Okay.
What do you say, Buzz? Not allowable?
He raises a great point, a couple of them. You know, the idea of the combined sewer outfall where the stormwater and the sewage is going to one pipe, when they set it up way back when, it just ran out into the bay.
Mm.
So when that was no longer something they could deal with, that's when they had to build the sewage treatment plants, the plants.
Mm.
So they were built wherever they could. And the infrastructure at that point, they invested so much money. As he said, how are we going to redo the whole thing? I don't suspect that we're going to see everybody in the city of New York go to composting toilets. But if a certain volume did, everybody that would do that would say, it's about a 40 to 50% savings in water from your household if you go to a composting toilet. It's definitely harder in the city where you have no place to take that compost when it's done and put it on trees or, you know, plants out in the fields.
Mm.
But the other side of this is, and that's just talking cities. You talk about in Vermont, where most of us are in, or a lot of us anyway, are out in the, you know, living on land that's far away from any kind of municipal system. We're on septic systems. You know, my septic system here was $18,000 5 years ago.
Mm.
And I'm very interested in preserving that septic system forever and ever and ever. And having been in the trades my whole life, those septic systems are very much subject to wearing out, especially drain fields, leach fields.
So if you keep the heavy organic waste from the feces out of them, then you can preserve their life.
Oh, yeah. If you're just sending down there just plain water, you're going to have far less impact on your sewage system, far less maintenance.
Right.
It lasts a whole lot longer.
Right. Well,
from that point of view, it's a good investment to make.
Right.
Not replacing your septic system.
Right. Well, I think Dick has a really good point about the need for some sort of guarantees about the collection system for the compost, that if you just take these buckets out and put them on the street corner full of sawdust and feces, then that's a recipe for trouble. I mean, dogs will get in them, if nothing else. You need a professional system for collecting it. Are you aware of any place that has such a system for composting toilets?
Actually, the Bronx Zoo is the only thing I can think of. It's the largest composting toilet facility I know. I think it has 15 or 20 or 30 composting toilets in it to deal with all the visitors it gets. There's a huge, huge new bathroom, both one for men and one for women. And they have a whole series of composting toilets. It's in the city. Of course, the zoo has a lot of other manure they're already dealing with, so they already have that stream of manure they can take their compost and plug it into.
Right.
But they also have a gray water system there, so all the hand washing and all the water from the sinks doesn't go into that Owl's Head plant.
The gray water is a water that's not connected to the toilet.
The gray water is the water, depending on who you talk to, the definition of it, that doesn't have any human feces in it.
Right.
Waste or urine or feces.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so it's washing machine, it's hand washing, it's showers, it's kitchen sink. It's not typically pathogenic in any way, so it's less dangerous. So the graywater system, a graywater system deals just with that, treats that water to a higher degree to remove the suspended organic particles, the fibers, and then that water is put out in typically a very simple kind of absorption field. Like at the zoo, it's put into the Bronx Zoo, it's put into the garden beds around the toilets.
Mm. If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Buzz Ferver. He's a local wastewater expert here in Worcester, Vermont. And he was a featured speaker at the Kellogg Hubbard Library last Thursday night as part of Transition Town Montpelier's Third Thursday series on reskilling, finding the skills that we need to get by in a life with a lot less oil. And as soon as the emergency subsides in the background there...
The battery's failing on my smoke alarm.
Shoot. Can we get you back in a minute when you take care of that, Buzz?
Can you still hear it?
It's gone now.
Yeah, yep. Good.
Okay, we've got the phones lighting up here, and we're running out of time, so we're going to go quickly to Montpelier and talk to Dave. Hello,
hi,
Dave.
Hi, Carl. Hi, Buzz. How are you?
Hey, Dave.
Good. What's up?
It's been a few months, but you had some guests on talking about chloramine and municipal wastewater treatment. I was wondering if you could revisit that on a program in the near future. Everybody I've talked to about it has been completely dumbfounded that this is a public health issue. So I just kicked that out there, and maybe you and Buzz could talk about it
a little bit more.
Maybe somebody who hasn't heard about it could hear about it from you guys.
Thanks for the suggestion. I think it might have been one of the other hosts of Equal Time, either Travin or Anthony Polina, who did that.
Could very well have been. I remember it was in this particular time slot.
Okay. Well,
and my apologies, it wasn't you, but it was a good show. It was a good show. So
I will email out my fellow hosts and let them know. Thanks for the call, Dave.
Good enough. Thank you.
Buzz, any comments on chloramine?
I'm going to stay off the chloramine issue for today.
Okay, very good.
I definitely don't think it's a good idea, but, you know, once again, pathogens.
Right. We'll go to Ron in Middlebury then. Hello, Ron.
Hi, Carl. Ron Slava. Joined the conversation late, but just heard this last little bit. I've used a sawdust toilet at Jenkins, and I don't know if you said that, but...
We were just talking about that. Yeah, I know you teach courses on that, Ron.
Pardon?
Yeah, we were just talking about that toilet, and I know you teach courses on how to put one of those together.
I've done workshops on that. I've used it myself. I heard Buzz say 7 years. I mean, if you got a system that you wait that long, that's fine. But the Jenkins thing, you can have that compost ready in like 1 year. And when you were talking about the city, you know, there's a lot of attention right now to growing food in the city. And the permaculture teacher I had at Yestermorrow works in New York City, lives there, and works with people in little vacant lots or on the roof or little tiny places, decks, to grow food. And some of those places you could have a bin. My bins are used pallets, three-sided. Well, I put a fourth side up as I fill it so that I have a four-pallet deal. And that'll last a year. So if you have two of them, that you fill a second one while you're waiting on the first one to, and then you can use that. That could be right, you know, an insight place to do that in place. The other thing is on the cover of Jenkins' book is a humorous little picture of like the old milk trucks. You know, milk used to appear on the doorstep to deliver your milk. And it was a truck like that, only they were picking up the 5-gallon buckets. And you, when your bucket is full, you put a snap lid on it, so it's tight, there's no smell, dogs can't get into that. But then if we had, and he fantasizes about a system where somebody comes around and picks it up and leaves you empty, fresh buckets. And maybe when we get some pressure on us resource-wise, we'll be more open for a system like that.
Hmm. Okay, thanks for the call, Ron.
All right, thanks for all you do.
All right. Buzz, we've got about a minute left. What's your response to Ron's comments?
Well, I think, you know, we tend to really think about these issues and problems in terms of the American life that we perceive around us. But we have to remember that, I mean, around the world, there are right now, you know, probably, you know, between 1 and 2 billion people that haul water into their house, that have no running water, that are currently, you know, using some kind of bucket or other system like that to go to the bathroom in and take that out to somewhere, out to the woods, out to the fields. You know, in Asia, there's some great books kind of documenting the you know, the farming practices for the last 4,000 years in China, Japan, and elsewhere, using the, what they call the, you know, night soil as the one of the principal fertilizers to grow crops for all that time. And so we think of, you know, we think of ourselves here in the way New York City is, but there's a lot of cities worldwide that don't have sewage. And so there's, you know, there's going to be the Carl and I talked for a minute earlier, and we were talking about how does this relate to Transition Town.
And that's about all we have time for. So Buzz Ferber, thanks so much for joining the show. I think we need to do another whole show on wastewater.
I think we do, Carl. It's a great idea.
Okay.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for your time.
You bet. And another show on chloramines, it sounds like. Well, we heard in the first part of the show about how farmers make business decisions and they can farm smarter without farming harder and increase their nets. It's the Organic Farmers Business Handbook. We'll have the information about that up on the website right after the show. And wastewater, billions of dollars in upgrades for sewage treatment plants or more local solutions where we can keep the nutrients more local where they belong. How to do that. I'll also have, since we talked about the Jenkins system, the Humanure system, sawdust toilets, it's also called, we'll have some information about that at the website, which is equaltimeradio.com, and soon enough we'll get the audio from today's show. Thanks for the calls from Dick and Barry, David Montpelier, and Ron in Middlebury. I'm Carl Ettenayer. That's it for Monday's Equal Time. I'll be back next Monday. Artie Levine produced the show.
Oil Check-In, exploring the end of the age of oil.
Thanksgiving Day is a special day for those following the peak oil news. Geologist Kenneth DeFays, the author of Hubbert's Peak, predicted that Thanksgiving Day 2005 would mark the peak in world oil production. After that, world oil production would decline, irreversibly. And he may have been right. Crude oil production figures have been removed from the most widely influential official statistics. Even if crude production numbers were easily available, the numbers are so uncertain that it's hard to see anything other than the biggest trends. When DeFays made his prediction, almost 2 years before Thanksgiving 2005, his tongue was only slightly in his cheek. Oil production data are not nearly precise enough to establish a peak day. Was DeFays at least mostly right about the timing of peak oil? I looked for the answer in the official figures from the U.S. Department of Energy and the International Energy Agency in Paris. The main tables on world oil production no longer report what's called crude oil and condensate. Condensate is a byproduct of natural gas production. What they call oil production now includes all manner of liquid fuels, including ethanol and synthetic fuels. Peak oil is about, well, oil, not how much alcohol is produced. Probably, if I dug down into the websites or made some phone calls, I could find the crude oil data again. But when the two primary public energy reporting agencies in the world change the most prominent way they report oil production, and they do so in a way that could hide peak oil, I'm suspicious. Second, even if I found the crude oil and condensate numbers, it requires a leap of faith to believe them. Matthew Simmons is an investment banker with decades of experience in the oil industry. The way he tells it, the unaudited oil production figures sound suspiciously like the finance industry's CDOs, their collateralized debt obligations, the ones that played a big role in bringing down the world economy last year, when they turned out to be worth a lot less than people thought. Like CDOs, no one really knows what's in the oil production figures from each country. Incredibly enough, there's no outside auditor who checks them out. Simmons thinks that 2005 was a peak year for oil production. If so, DeFays might even have been right about oil production peaking on Thanksgiving that year. DeFays' prediction looks pretty good even if we look at the unreliable and misleading data on total liquids, including ethanol and synfuels. There was a rapid run-up in price from 2005 to 2008, which you'd think would lead to greater production, if that was possible. But no, production stagnated in 2006 and 2007, and only increased slightly in 2008. Since then, economic collapse has reduced demand, so production in 2009 is down again, below 2005 levels, according to the official figures. Regardless of the actual date of peak oil, we can give thanks for oil's blessings. As DeFays put it, quote, "Thanks for the services of the first half of recoverable world oil. Thanks for the automobile, the airplane, diesel trains and ships, two-lane blacktop, warm houses, plastics, and a huge range of petrochemicals. The Thanksgiving dinner itself was produced with fertilizers, tractor fuel, pesticides, and transportation provided by oil and natural gas." Unquote. Of course, oil has been a mixed blessing. The age of oil has also brought the age of world wars, poisonings from pollution on an unprecedented scale, destruction of cities for parking lots and ugly suburbs, habitat destruction, climate change, and other pressures that threaten most species on the planet, including ours. As we give thanks for the blessings of oil, let us keep in mind the curses of oil, and let us ask for the wisdom to use the remaining half of the world's oil reserves more for useful, durable products than, say, throwaway plastic cutlery, more for insulating homes and constructing wind turbines than for heating drafty homes and generating electricity by burning it, and more for medicines and food production than for guns and warplanes. Happy Thanksgiving. I'm Carl Ettnayer, and that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGBR.